Welcome to a special episode of The Big Something, in-depth conversations on culture and ideas in the Pikes Peak region. I'm Noel Black. On this week's show, we invited Dr. Heidi Lewis, Assistant Professor of Feminist and Gender Studies at Colorado College, and the Reverend Dr. Stephanie Rose, Associate Professor of Gender and Ethnic Studies at the University of Colorado at Colorado Springs, to sit down and talk about the ongoing issue of racism and violence against African-American communities, nationally and locally. Please note that the views and perspectives of Dr. Lewis and Dr. Rose are not necessarily those of KRCC or Colorado College.
My name is Dr. Heidi Renee Lewis. I'm an assistant professor of feminist and gender studies at Colorado College, where I'm also an affiliate in the race and ethnic studies program. And I'm joined today by my colleague and friend, the Reverend Dr. Stephanie Stiletto Rose, who is an associate professor of women's and ethnic studies at the University of Colorado at Colorado Springs, as well as a pastor at Ebenezer Baptist Church here in Colorado Springs. So thank you for joining me, Stephanie. I'm really happy to be sitting here with you talking about these things.
Thank you, Dr. Lewis. I'm excited, too. I'm glad to be here.
And I mean, I'm really excited to be here with you, especially because so much of what's been happening in the United States for as long as we can remember and even before we were born, but especially at this particular time where there seems to be heightened attacks of terrorism on Black communities, especially in the Black church spaces here in the U.S. As of today, there have been 7 attacks, I think.
Yes.
7 on Black churches.
Yes.
In the U.S. And one of the things I've been thinking about even before all this started happening is how can we have these conversations across communities, intellectual communities, whether they be in the church, in the academy, in the artistic world. And I think you're a great example of how that happens. So I'm just hoping maybe you could talk about your thoughts and feelings about these burnings, these attacks, as a scholar, a pastor who's committed to eradicating white supremacy, sexism, and all forms of oppression.
Yeah, it's absolutely enraging and just utterly disgusting and dehumanizing to see what is going on in this country. And it's also extremely disappointing, as much as we being in this generation are well enough in terms of intellectually well enough aware of the kind of racism that continues to proliferate throughout the country. But we have in some ways trained ourselves or taught ourselves to believe in this idea that post-civil rights things have gotten better and people have become absolutely more polite and like to sweep conversations under the rug. So I do agree with you that these conversations are definitely necessary, especially being in the classroom at a predominantly white institution in a very evangelical space that Colorado Springs is, and as well conservative space. There is this notion that we are so far beyond race, and these incidents remind us of how much we have left before us in terms to do. So with the massacre in South Carolina, thinking about our 9 brothers and sisters who were in worship and doing the kind of work that they understood spiritually to be doing by inviting their neighbor to come in and participate in worship with them, and then to have this kind of atrocity happen. There are a lot of things that I could potentially say about it from a theological perspective to a communal perspective. But one thing that having to go back in these last few weeks and have conversations with my congregants, one of the most powerful things, of course, is this idea and notion of forgiveness as a spiritual responsibility, particularly for those of faith that walk in Christianity, is rousing for those who don't necessarily or desire to claim that Christian perspective. It's troubling, and having to read and know the variety of perspectives that people, particularly communities of color and Black people who are not necessarily there in their faith and in that work. And so having to, on one hand, to hold that, which feels like a contradiction. And I feel like I'm in the middle of a Fitzgerald moment, mm-hmm. an F. Scott Fitzgerald. And for the listeners, I am an American literate, so when it comes to Mark Twain and F. Scott Fitzgerald, and people
comes
like
out.
it comes out, right? But it feels like, you know, that these moments where we are holding contradictory ideas in the same vein without losing sanity, right? So right. On one hand, having a Christian community knowing that in their spiritual space and faith and place that this act of forgiveness is a responsibility spiritually, but forgiveness doesn't mean that justice is not to be sought or to be pursued vigilantly. And when I say vigilantly, I don't equate that with violence. But the act of justice is also what we are compelled to do in our spiritual practice as well. So these conversations, not just conversations, but the conversations need to happen, but also work in communities. I'm reminded, I attended the Payne Chapel vigil here.
Mm-hmm.
The Friday after the massacre, and one of the speakers articulated what we know a lot in faith communities is that Sundays is a very, you know, it's still the most segregated hour, the 11 o'clock mm-hmm. hour on Sunday, as Dr. King pointed out decades ago. And part of me as a community activist is like, well, if we know that, if we keep saying that mm-hmm. and if we keep articulating that we want something different in our community, then what do we do? Like, I'm so tired of you telling me what the problem is. There needs to be direct action to address the kind of self-segregation that we continue to live in that leads to the devaluing of each other because we don't know each other, because we refuse to see humanity in one another. And there are, beyond just sitting down and having conversations, there's real things that we have to just be able to do with each other, because this racism, this sexism, this classism, and all kind of like forms of oppression is not what a just God desires for his people. So,
I mean, I love what you said about the vigilant pursuit of justice, because I think one of the things that a lot of people misunderstand is that when people like you and I, at least, are talking about love and forgiveness, there's a real strong component called accountability.
Right.
That exists there. And so it's not a sort of blind love or a blind forgiveness that sort of encourages and nurtures and supports abuse and oppression. It's the kind of love that demands justice for and, those kinds of things.
And the ability to call each other out and to right. check and to walk with a community, walk with a person, to getting themselves together.
Exactly. As much as it takes. I mean, I work specifically, as you know, with the student population. That's where I feel most safe and comfortable. And I have to tell them this all the time. There is no love without accountability in these kinds of spaces that we're imagining. Mm-hmm. So there's not a sort of Dylan Roof gets to be forgiven without being held accountable right. for the murder. That's not how that kind of love and forgiveness works. There have been a lot of people in my social media spaces who have been really critical of the families of these victims for taking that kind of stance. You know, we forgive, we have to forgive because we don't want to harbor hate for these perpetrators. As a pastor, but as a pastor who I think is very committed to intellectualism, mm-hmm. so this isn't sort of just a Jesus said we will do, it's a very critical kind of spirituality. Can you help people understand why that position may have been taken? I know you don't know them personally and you can't speak to them, but I think people need to also try to understand where they're coming from. And then I also want to talk about why that sort of jars people.
Okay. So two things that I spoke to my congregation about is the kind of release and relief personally that comes through forgiveness, right? So psychologists will talk about this beyond just a spiritual space, that one's own healing is wrapped in the ability to move beyond what the trauma is and to release it from your spirit. Not that these families are not dealing with grief or that mm-hmm. they move too quickly or what have you, but to hold on to the anger, to hold on to the pain and the trauma itself denigrates one's own spirit. Mm. So it's not even for Dylann Roof, right? Mm. It's for the families so that they can continue to walk in body and spirit and in truth mm-hmm. for themselves. At least that is my perspective from a spiritual standpoint of how and why forgiveness happens, mm-hmm. that it's not for the person, like regardless of the individual or the community, if they even ask for forgiveness themselves, it's for those who have been traumatized and victimized so that they can move to the next space of not being victims, but you know, but being survivors and being alive and being fully present and in control of who they are and who their humanity is and how they construct it for themselves. So that's one thing. And then on the other level, I, again, being Christian, think about the Calvary moment that we as Christians celebrate and that sacrifice that was made for us in our salvation. But I also remind my congregation that Calvary didn't happen without Judas. So for the work that is ahead for us to be doing as a nation, Dylann Roof becomes a catalyst for that, right? Because so much has been swept under the rug in regard right. to white supremacy. And now you have in relationship to all of these social media technologies and spaces and places where people can have conversations, they're having conversations that they would not have normally had and are being confronted with public media and with the people that they quote unquote call friends having to address, right? Having to
blocking
address
and deleting for
blocking,
a while.
Deleting, and all the other, but still having to come face to face with the reality that this is not a post-racial society.
No, and I really think that's important to point out. I mean, I'm always thinking about, as you know, the work of thought. Like I'm just there because it's so difficult to move past that when we're talking about people's actions. You know, you have to think that, you know, this young black woman is dangerous in a particular kind of way in order to immediately pull out a firearm and then shoot to kill.
Right.
You know, there are a lot of us who would see the same people that have been murdered, just switching gears a little bit to the other kinds of murders that have happened. There are a lot of us who would have seen those same victims and our attitudes and behaviors would have been totally different. I keep saying, if it is true that it was raining on the night that Trayvon Martin was walking home, I mean, I probably would have been like, you need a ride.
Right.
You know what I mean? If we're in the same community small, you probably saw this kid several times in the hallway or wherever. So there's a thinking that's happening that leads people to this idea that we're in a society that is post-racial, post-racism. Right. And it doesn't help when we have prominent black people in media perpetuating an idea that we are, because it almost seems
like Don Lemon.
Don Lemon, Pharrell Williams. And it's really difficult, I find, to try to have the conversations we want to have and to do the things we want to do when people's thought is still stuck there.
So what I talk about in my research and even in my book, Abolishing White Masculinity,
yes.
is the reality that white supremacist ideology is alluring.
It
not
is
just to
so
not
pervasive.
Just to those who identify or identified
right.
as white, but because it is the norm in terms of the dominant narrative, because it is such a normalized perspective mm-hmm. that there are people regardless of race, regardless of ethnicity, that buy into what white supremacist ideology is.
Yes.
And that's the only way that hegemony works.
I was going to say.
Through consent, right?
Right.
So
who wouldn't want to be at the top when the top looks like that?
Exactly. So then when you come across these individuals like a Stacey Dash. And,
oh, right. Her too, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's this idea that they buy into the mythology of merit and meritocracy, and the American dream is available to any and everyone as long as you work hard. And it's not because
didn't
I'm a
Donald
woman.
Trump say that recently? If the,
right.
the Mexicans can stay here if they work hard,
and if Black lives don't matter in the U.S. Go back to
wherever they matter.
Right.
Nowhere. No. I don't know where that is, but okay.
But yeah, so white supremacist ideology doesn't work simply because white people invest in it, but because there are other communities that invest in the idea that this is normal, that capitalism is normal. Like, to not even be able to imagine a world without capitalism, right? To not be able to imagine a world without hierarchy and competition. When I first moved out here, I was in a classroom, a leadership classroom, and there were students that were literally just arguing the absoluteness for competition. Like, competition is
a necessary
is
element
essential
of success.
To all organisms. And I'm like, well,
I don't mean to laugh, but it's sad.
There are clearly organisms that don't organize themselves in competition with one another. And when we think about indigenous thought, when we go back to Native American practice, or other indigenous communities around the world that's not so minority, like most communities, they're more collective.
I think one of my points that I try to get across is that the hardest work is the most invisible. It's easy to say we don't want the Confederate flag.
Right.
And I don't. Right. I mean, it feels great to go to Berlin, like I've been doing, and not see the Nazi flag. Now, to be fair, neo-Nazis have come up with far more creative ways to express their terrorism. So, for instance, they wear tattooed eights on their forearms, which is because H is the eighth letter of the alphabet. So Heil Hitler in eights instead of the flag. So it's not as though that solves everything. But
right.
I don't want to see the Nazi flag hanging around Berlin. I don't want to see the Confederate flag hanging around here. But I also recognize that it's a symbol and that we have to do both things. You know what I mean? We have to do the invisible work of removing the flag and the invisible work of getting people to work on the ways that they think as a result of what that flag has come to mean.
Exactly. So in this moment, if we make the massacre about simply the flag and like, oh, let's take down the flag.
And then it's over.
Then exactly. And so we're a better community now.
Right.
Absolutely not. Which is the fault lines that we are crossing now, because that's what people thought. We needed the Civil Rights Act,
that's
and
right.
then we were done.
Affirmative action.
And
here.
Absolutely not, right? Because
right.
because then the work became more insidious, right? It's
right.
less recognizable in terms of what we have to do to address what institutional and structural racism is, which is why the Supreme Court is now looking at what? Affirmative
I
action.
I know, again. And that's the thing that I always think that people have to understand is that when people like you and I celebrate as we mourn, because we do, the reason that we continue to be critical and to keep our eyes on the next thing is because every time we don't, bad things happen. Every
right.
time women and people who love women take their eyes off of that wage gap, the wage gap increases. Then we go, oh, we should be paying attention to that. And then we do. And then you could look at the grid. It just goes up and down, up and down. And so I think it's important for people to understand that it's not that we want to just constantly be bringing ants to your picnic. And we do know how to,
well, we can't even have our moment without you people saying there's something else wrong,
because there's still a lot wrong.
Right.
There's still a lot wrong. It's almost like, I always say I use my family as an example just because it's, people know how much I love them. And so if I'm this way with them, why would I be any other way with anything else? I mean, if my son has 10 math problems and 8 of them are wrong, we could celebrate those right two for a minute, but
right.
we need to fix these other 8. I don't understand why it's difficult but it's very difficult because people enjoy celebrating more than the hard work.
We understand issues in silos. And I ask my students, when I walk into a room, what do they see? Particularly on the first day of class. And they're like, I see a black woman who's my professor, yada, yada, yada. And I'm like, so when I woke up this morning, could I not be black and just walk into the room as a woman? Like, could I have taken off my blackness?
Right. Could I have chosen one?
Right. So intersectionality is the reality that our identities are not separate from one another. So when we have issues where the LGBTQI community are celebrating on this Supreme Court ruling about gay marriage, you still have people of color saying, like, but my, like, yes, I can get a marriage license now, but if I don't make it to the courthouse because the police shot me, then what does a marriage license mean?
Absolutely.
Because I'm still always going to be black and, when I walk into a courthouse.
Right. And not, and in addition to that, there are many people in the LGBTQI community who are white also and of color who are asking, how closely are these rights connected to things that are also very detrimental to us? So that when I got married, me, we got a lower car insurance rate. We got, you know, we, if we owned a home, we would get those things right. All these rights. And at first sight, you're like, yes, I want other people to have them. But then what are we saying about single people? Why? I mean, I have
clearly.
And my thing is this. I have a two-income household. I probably need the benefit less than you. I mean, you're a single woman. I have kids. You don't. I mean, that's the other thing, too. People have to understand some of us are committed to dismantling these systems.
Right.
So we're not going to celebrate when other people are allowed in.
Right.
Because the point is not to get people in. The point is to dismantle the system. That's not all of us. But I'm just saying some of us who take a very radical intersectional framework for looking at these institutions, intersectional being what you said, being we're not just thinking about sexuality. We're not just thinking about race. We're not just thinking about age. We're thinking about as many of those facets of ourselves as we possibly can.
All at the same time.
All at the
same
time.
Because they never segregate themselves
never.
Out. Never separate themselves.
Never. And you know one of the things I started saying to students because, of course, and I love, because the students are young. So when I'm talking about them saying they should be, they're 18. I have undergraduate students. They are young. They should be asking these things. And one of the things they ask about intersectionality is, how can you possibly, I mean, that's just a lot. You know, that's a lot. I mean, you got to think about the race, the gender. The class. And the first thing I think is, see, this is one of the things that's happening in this moment. I noticed with all these tragedies and traumas that have been being inflicted upon so many of us is this. People don't have a sort of ontological, meaning the ways we be, the ways we are, or epistemological, the ways we know, respect for us. You would never go into a chemistry lab and ask them to simplify that for you. You would never be like, oh, my God, it's too hard. All these chemicals coming together to make this gaseous planet Mars.
Or not even simplify it to tell you that, oh, that's just an opinion. That's just, you know, like how you think
part.
About these chemicals operating. I know that they blew up the last time that I mixed them together, but I think you're just like talking out the side of your neck.
And this is why I think some of these issues, like we're talking about people's murder, I think the conversations that we're trying to have about it, people's rights to this and rights to that, and what are rights and rights to what and rights for who, is that there's so much participation in the conversation from people who don't have that kind of commitment. It's easy to put up a Facebook profile picture with the thing. I could do, but where you gotta be there. For me, you have to be there even when it's not happy.
But that comes with the kind of disregard that we have for the scholarship, the disregard that we have for the discipline itself. Like we, even in academia, we are wrestling with administrators who are saying, oh, well, you know, that women's and ethnic studies hasn't been around like 100 years. So the rigor is probably not there. And you're like, are you serious?
Yes,
because
they're very serious.
After almost 60 years of doing this work and engaging and you as someone who's like a mathematician, you're going to tell me what my discipline is.
I'm telling
and so
you.
I tell my students, I'm like, there's no way in the world if you walked or if at some point your eye was dangling out of its socket and almost falling into your hand, you wouldn't go to the dog catcher to ask them what to do. Which
exactly.
is why this conversation is so mind-blowing to me, the ways in which that we, through popular media, through news media, we use just anybody who we think has a pulpit and a voice to say anything without looking to those who are actually doing this work.
You're listening to a special episode of The Big Something on KRCC featuring a conversation between Dr. Heidi Lewis, Assistant Professor of Feminist and Gender Studies at Colorado College, and the Reverend Dr. Stephanie Rose, Associate Professor of Gender and Ethnic Studies at the University of Colorado at Colorado Springs. We'll be right back. Welcome back to this special episode of The Big Something, in-depth conversations on culture and ideas in the Pikes Peak region. I'm Noel Black. If you're just joining us, Dr. Heidi Lewis, Assistant Professor of Feminist and Gender Studies at Colorado College, and the Reverend Dr. Stephanie Rose, Associate Professor of Gender and Ethnic Studies at UCCS, are discussing ongoing racism and violence against African American communities. In this segment, they discuss white supremacy, institutional racism, and the invisible structures of oppression. The first voice you'll hear is that of Dr. Lewis.
I know some fierce white supremacists that are black as me because they've bought into this idea that whiteness is supreme. And however that manifests, whether it's the music we listen to, the food that we eat, the ways that we study, the ways that we talk, the ways that we write, the ways that we read. I mean, everything that we do has sort of been denigrated in that way. And it doesn't, white people aren't the only people that do that.
But again, when we think about these CNN panels or these HuffPost panels where the idea of racism is, or even white supremacy is boiled down to individual acts.
And visible stuff like burning
somebody
something.
Spit in your face,
right.
Or called you a name,
right.
That was a racial slur or what have you. When we leave that as the mass conversation, it does a disservice to the actual work that has to be done for dismantling institutional racism.
Yes.
So people aren't even aware of the disconnect that's happening because they don't know, which makes the work that we do that much more relevant, but also that much harder.
Harder. And you know, another thing I was thinking about, too, in terms of just, you know, the significance of not the academy, but intellectualism, is that I have struggled a great deal with the reactions that people have had to the myriad ways that we as communities under attack have responded. So if you respond like this, you're not going to get what you want. If you respond like this, you're not going to get what you want. And the problem that I have with so much of that is it's indicative of a lack of serious intellectual commitment to what we do, because everything they suggest we've already tried.
Right.
And it didn't work either. I love teaching my feminist theory class because, you know, all the things about feminism, right? And all this stuff that people, these ideas that people have because what they know is informed by so much misinformation. One of the things I love is when we get to like the supremely radical, just raw, hardcore feminists, and the students will respond like, see, this is why, you know, people have a problem with feminism because of the Red Stockings and la, 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 la. The Red Stockings are a group that wrote a sort of really inflammatory essay, as you
right.
know, that was very hyperbolic and, you
right.
know, kill the men and all this stuff. But one of the things I always say to them is, well, let's look at the more nice liberals and ask yourself what we have that they ask for, because it's nothing. And I'm not saying you should be mean and violent or whatever, but what I'm saying is if you really study change and movement, it has always required all of us to participate. The more liberal of us, the more radical of us, some of us on the inside, some of us on the outside. There's never been any, you know, we can think about, you talked about women's studies and black studies.
Right.
I mean, in North Carolina, Stephanie and I might not have a job tomorrow because they're eradicating women's studies programs, black studies programs.
Right.
And one of the things that we have to think about, too, is how do we get those? People didn't just go to the dean or the provost and say, can we please have black studies? And
they locked
said,
down
yes.
the university.
They locked down the university. And think Kent State. I would never want anybody to make movement in a way that wasn't comfortable for them. But I think that we just, before we start to weigh in on the ways that these people are responding to their own terrorism, we have to think about how people have done that for hundreds of years.
Yes.
I mean, because I think one of the interesting things about it now is that people are so angry with us, and when I say us, I mean black people, about the ways that we're responding to all this state-sanctioned violence and all this intracommunal violence and everything. I wonder if one day they'll romanticize this moment, like look at Baltimore or Ferguson, the way they do the civil rights movement now. You look at that and you're like, oh, look at those mean police and those innocent people. But you look at us today like we're animals.
Sure. Absolutely. I have no doubt that in 50 years,
they'll be like, oh, wow.
Exactly. Like, oh, they
so
shut
strong.
The highway down.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, that was really radical and necessary for what needed to be done. But right now, in the midst of a movement, it's like, I need to get to work. And so you all are stopping the traffic.
And they had a brother on the camera saying that. You know, it's like, man, you know, it's a better way. Ja Rule on Fox News talking about it's a better way.
Because it's the norm. It's the normalized perception, which is where we don't even question, like, how these infrastructures, the physical geographical infrastructures, support the system and the structures of oppression. And granted, I hear the arguments that you know, someone was in an ambulance mm-hmm. and they didn't make it to the hospital. Mm-hmm. And I know and I recognize all of those. And I'm not advocating, like, I am a nonviolent advocate. That's who I am mm-hmm. personally. But the reality is, even from a spiritual space, Jesus had to die.
Exactly. And the other thing about that, too, I mean, I love that you said that, because the other thing about it, too, is that there are some people that we would never ask to think it through and to, you know, find a peaceful way. You know, if you're being attacked in the middle of the night, in the middle of the street,
which is
what do you want me to do?
Ask most of these individuals who are causing the kind of terror that people of color are experiencing in their lives. That's their response. That I was afraid of my life, so I pulled out my gun and killed them before they could kill me.
See, this is the invisible thing. You remember when Darren Wilson was talking about his experience with Michael Brown? And he said that Michael Brown looked like
a demon.
See, that's invisible. There's no policy that you can put into place. There's nothing the SCOTUS can do. There's nothing the POTUS can do about a man looking at another human being in that way. Not to say that the SCOTUS shouldn't be hard at work and the POTUS shouldn't be hard at work, but he saw him in a particular way. That's purely theoretical. You saw him and you thought something.
Well, it's psychological,
yes.
Right? Because he's been conditioned in many ways, and not just him. There have been studies, again, going back to the scholarship, to the research, there have been studies by psychologists that articulate regardless of race, that police force after police force across this country, that people have been so conditioned, and we can turn to Marlon Riggs' Ethnic Notion,
yes.
to see black bodies, particularly black male bodies. This doesn't discount the ways in which black women are characterized and understood, but to see and to visualize them as hyperviolent, as hypersexual, as inhuman, right? And so this work that has been conditioned for years and years and years of a person's life has to be undone.
It has to be undone
psychologically, but it takes different kinds of messages to reprogram someone's brain, right? Like, it is that invisible work.
My students, they've been taught so much that they gotta see something. What does it look like?
Right.
It's very difficult. And one of the things you said that made me think of when we're talking about black bodies, it made me think of the recent. So, you know, at the end of the spring semester last year, a lot of my students and I and some other people at my campus did a Black Women Matter campaign.
Yes.
And one of the things that we were trying to do was not to take away, whatever that means, from terrorism directed at black men, but to ask why black women were so invisible, even though, as you always point out, and I do too, that three black queer women started the Black
Yes.
Lives Matter hashtag. How do we remain so invisible? And I think one of the things that has happened with us black women is that people think of us as always already strong and resilient. They think it's a compliment, and you're so strong, and all black women. And there's TV shows now. I want to find my inner black woman, and they take this frumpy white woman and dress her up in all these black clothes and teach her so she can get
or
strong.
Rachel Dolezal.
Or Rachel Dolezal shows up. And I think we've bought into that as well. We as black women, because it's like, hey, yes, I am strong. I want to be strong. But what we've done that I don't think, I mean, we've known this. Black women have been writing about this since the 1800s and before that.
Right.
So we have known. But I think one of the things we need to remind ourselves is that we are also human, and we also need things like love.
Yes.
And affection.
Yes.
And care and empathy.
Yes.
And that we're not bricks walking around unrapeable, unbeatable, unkillable.
Ready to carry everybody's burden. The mules of the earth.
And I'm telling you, when I was a little girl and I read Zora Neale Hurston's Their Eyes Are Watching God for the first time, what you just said, that quote never left me. We have to tell ourselves what no one tells us. We have to do it. You know what I'm saying? Because even within communities, sometimes we forget that we also need to be treated. All of us, regardless, should be treated as fully human. But Black women, women of color, period, in particular, just there's a way in which, I mean, I remember when I was a little girl, there was a video game on Atari where you got points for raping an Indian woman.
Which is crazy.
Like, that. I was born in the 80s. I wasn't born in, what do people say, 400 years ago? No, I was born in 1981. So this video game was in the 1980s. And you would get points, General Custer, if you raped a Native woman. We know what happens to them on the reservation. It's like a hunting ground. So I think one of the things that I'm trying to do, and I think you're trying to do the same thing, is just to demand that people see our humanity.
Yes, and even see the ways in which their humanity has been robbed for being conditioned to think about other beings and other bodies in that way, as rapeable, as discardable, as killable, you know, just to their own humanity has been taken from them because we haven't been able to see these kind of embedded ethnic notions that are so dominant in our society, but they go unnoticed, right? That they go unchallenged. And one of the greatest aha moments a lot of times in the classroom is when we begin to decode media for
it's
students,
my favorite
class, right?
You know
whether it's Disney movies,
yes.
And then you have all of these, particularly in my setting, you have these middle-class white fathers who's like, my daughter's never watching Disney again. Right?
You're right. I think it's important. I think, but one of the things you're talking about that I think is really difficult in a sort of hyper-capitalist hegemonic society that sort of demands that we think only of ourselves. You know, we built it, rugged individualism, myth of meritocracy, so I earned whatever I have and I, is that it's really hard to have empathy for other people. And everything that we do requires you
empathy.
To have deep
not
empathy.
Sympathy.
Not sympathy, empathy, because you can't. Because, you know, I can't sympathize with LGBTQ folks. I'm very heterosexual. When I hold hands with my husband, we actually get applause because people are like, oh, look at the Black people that stayed together. Yeah. So nobody's in disgust
right.
when we kiss. We actually get like, oh, high five, Black love,
right? And they got the kids with
them. Look at the little two kids, a girl and a boy and a cat, you know. So I can't sympathize with the LGBTQ struggle, but I have to make sure that my empathy runs deep because if it doesn't, that's sort of the exact opposite antithesis to the work that we do. We have to care about each other. It's that simple. We have to go back to kindergarten with this stuff.
But that, and to bring it full circle, is the spiritual space from which we emerge, right? When the commandment is changed from love thy neighbor to amend it to love thy neighbor as thyself.
My grandfather used to say that.
And then to love thy neighbor as I have loved you. So even better, like, because you might not know how to love yourself, right?
Exactly.
So
Tony K. Bambara said, I'll be damned if I want somebody doing unto me
right,
as they want
as
people
they
to do unto
them. Right. So even beyond the example of, or even beyond the space in which you know how to love yourself, then you have to move, for me, in a faith community,
right.
You have to move into a Christ-like love that might charge you to love somebody better than you would love yourself, because this is the example that is set in a spiritual space. So going back to the forgiveness, going back to the healing and the work that's necessary even for those families, and this racial work. When I first moved out here, there was a colleague of mine who is Jewish American. And we were at a conference listening to Joy DeGruy. If you do not know who she is, I encourage you to look her up. She talks about post-traumatic slave syndrome, which is just, you know, psychically phenomenal in terms of the work that she does. But we were at a talk where Joy DeGruy was presenting. And afterwards, my colleague, who's Jewish American, came up to me and she was just like, how is it even possible? Like, how is it even possible that you would sign on to come out to Colorado Springs and to do this work every day and to do this work with us as white, you know, as white people that have done and committed like this kind of atrocity? And for me, again, as an African-American woman whose faith tradition is rooted in Christianity, my faith, my spirit requires it. And when I talk about Christianity, be very, very clear, I am not talking about an understanding or an interpretation that is rooted in oppression, rooted in whiteness.
Oh, I know you did not know.
You know, and for a lot of people who don't recognize or even understand that I'm the first Christian who are Orthodox Ethiopians, that it is very, very different kind of spiritual, psychic, and cosmic work that's happening.
You're listening to a special episode of The Big Something on KRCC featuring a conversation between Dr. Heidi Lewis, Assistant Professor of Feminist and Gender Studies at Colorado College, and the Reverend Dr. Stephanie Rose, Associate Professor of Gender and Ethnic Studies at UCCS. We'll be right back. Welcome back to this special episode of The Big Something, in-depth conversations on culture and ideas in the Pikes Peak region. I'm Noel Black. In this final segment, Dr. Heidi Lewis, Assistant Professor of Feminist and Gender Studies at Colorado College, and the Reverend Dr. Stephanie Rose, Associate Professor of Gender and Ethnic Studies at the University of Colorado at Colorado Springs, discuss racism and violence against African-American communities here locally in the Pikes Peak region. The first voice you'll hear is that of Dr. Lewis.
You know, one of the things that I've been thinking about, and I know you have too, is you probably more than me, are some of the issues that have been happening right here in Colorado Springs.
Yes.
That are very similar to what's happening throughout this country and the world when it comes to Black and brown people. Because I think it's important to talk about that, because so much of our theorizing or thinking about racism is simplistic in that we imagine it as very visible acts that happen in Southern backwards America.
Or external from my community, right?
There you
like
go.
It's not my family, it's not the people up the street from me, it's not right here in this space. And I, again, with my students, with my colleagues, very often, you know, we did a Black Lives Matter conference at UCCS. And having to articulate to them that though I am your professor, you see me as a colleague, some of you see me as friends, see me as teacher. When I leave this campus, and even sometimes when I'm on this campus, I'm still an African-American woman. And it would not take much for me to be walking into the grocery store and be shot. Right.
Or in an open carry state.
Or in my neighborhood, in my community, and knowing that I have to take extra precautions, regardless of whether the precautions are good or not, they're never good enough.
Exactly.
Because if I am out at 6:15 in the morning where the deers are still just clearing their way from, you know, the fields or anything like that, someone could potentially roll down the street and say, this woman doesn't belong in this neighborhood because of the neighborhood in which I live,
exactly.
Right? That is predominantly white, looks a certain kind of way, and Lord, please don't let me wear a hoodie because it might be chilly that morning. And so to have to even think about that as a Black woman here in Colorado Springs, and knowing that it's not something that I'm making up. We can look at the brothers who were pulled over for driving while Black just very recently in this in this city, or even the response to the bombing at the NAACP office. And again, while there is there's the rhetoric that, well, it might not have been a target. Mm-hmm. The NAACP might not have been a target. It could have just been the tax company or the barbershop that was there. The reality is that building, that business is representative historically in this community of Black business, Black wealth and activism and work or whatever, the three businesses that are located there. So whether you are targeting the NAACP or Mr. G's, you're still targeting Black bodies,
right? And I mean, and I think that one of the things that we get to have is that kind of skepticism. It makes me think of, you know, people who say it's not always about race. You always make it about race. Listen, I make the sun always about heat.
Right.
That's how I feel about it. I make cold, the snow always about cold. I mean, this is the way that we've sort of experienced life. And we're in our 30s. I can't imagine what it would be like to be 50 years old, like my father, your parents 60 years old, you know, having to live in this kind of world for
Absolutely.
That many years.
Or it makes it easier to write away, right? So if the target is not this historical symbol, you know, like the NAACP, then it doesn't matter that these businesses and the bodies that
exactly.
occupy this space were Black, and that this person intentionally put and set off and tried to destroy this space with a bomb, right? Or even what's happening at the churches, that the language, the rhetoric, again, we don't know exactly. They do have a suspect right now,
right,
who happens to be Black. Regardless, the rhetoric and the nature of the conversation and the discourse, that this person was trying to instill a kind of terror against Black bodies.
Well, you know, when I was teaching, it was insane that when George Zimmerman was acquitted, I was teaching my critical whiteness studies class at the time. And the first day after the verdict, I wrote on the board, how could this be racism / white supremacy if George Zimmerman is a man of color? Because anybody can be conditioned to be afraid of the Black male body, even if it's another Black male body.
Right.
I mean, look at Bill Cosby for the many years. I mean, and I'm not even talking about his gruesome track record of rape and sexual assault. I'm talking about the way that he has hated Black people.
Mm-hmm.
In his many speeches, denigrating us for names that we have, for the ways that we speak, for the things that we choose to do in our lives in terms of career. So this is another Black man. Look at Clarence Thomas.
Yes.
Clarence Thomas might be one of the most ardent white supremacists I know
yes.
of in my life. So I think one of the things that's happening with these bombings and these, you know, we're not looking for, we don't need to find a white perpetrator in order for white supremacy to be at play.
Right. So again, so white skin is not the requirement.
Yes, not a requirement.
It's not the requirement.
We know many sexist women.
Ideology. Absolutely.
We know many LGBTQ folk who have a deep hatred for LGBTQ folk.
Yes.
If they are not acting in a quote unquote respectable way, right? So we police each other very well. It's almost like the people who embody the identity that we're talking about don't even need to do the work, because we've bought into this thinking so much. But
and that's the root, right? Because we have to do the work just as much, because it's so endemic in the culture and the society that we have structured and articulate as America.
It keeps coming up, but I want to have a kind of more salient conversation about, you know, these issues of white guilt and white fragility, because you and I both teach critical whiteness studies. You and I both write about it, think about it all the time. You have this book that was just published not too long ago, Abolishing White Masculinity. And the question I want to ask you, what are some different strategies that you can give about how to deal with this white guilt, this white fragility? But before you do that, I want to say this. Not all of us want to do that, and not all of us have to do it, and not all of us are going to do it. See, you know, we all work to eradicate white supremacy and racism, but we all have unique ways of doing it. And I always use this example with my students. You kind of made a point like this earlier. You would not go to a dentist to get a pap smear, just as you would not go to a gynecologist to get a cavity fill. So we have to respect the nuances of those of us who do the work. So if in fact you approach someone who does this work and they are not interested or willing or able to take the time to coach you through whatever, you have to respect that and go to somebody who will. And I
Absolutely.
Know, you know what I mean? So
all doctors are not OBGYN,
yes.
even though they might do family practice.
There you go. And so, but for those of us who do this work of communicating with that white fragility and guilt, or those of us who are embodying that white fragility and guilt, what are some thoughts you have about it?
So definitely I would encourage all of us that are doing this work to not become paralyzed or to centralize on white fragility and white guilt, because that detracts from the dismantling of the work that needs to be done and that is before us. But I like to reiterate, particularly when it comes up in the classroom and even in the workshops that I conduct, I like to point to a narrative that Tim Wise shared mm-hmm. about responsibility mm-hmm. or accountability as opposed to guilt. Because, you know, a lot of the conversations when we deal with white guilt comes to, well, I didn't own slaves, right? And I didn't burn a cross on anybody's lawn. And because I didn't do these things, then I don't see how I can be held accountable for it. And you need to stop blaming me. First of all, the issue around dismantling racism institutionally is not about blame. It's about what is humanly right and honors human dignity. And so it's a responsibility of all of us. And so Tim Wise tells this story about being in college and in Louisiana. And, you know, whether this is a made up story or not, it's a great story. Right. and making a pot of gumbo. And the gumbo was really, apparently it was really good. And he was living in a house with a number of different people. And though he made the gumbo, everybody ate from the pot of gumbo, right? Like everybody got nourishment and benefited from the gumbo. And they like licked the bowls clean, right? But after you make gumbo, then what? There are dishes to be done. And, you know, there was some that was still left in the pot. And the dirty dishes were still in the kitchen. And everybody had gone their ways, including Tim. And they come back the one night, it's there, and nobody, you know, everybody's still mm-hmm. doing their thing, you know, like they have their other responsibilities, like, yo, I got to study for the exam, or whatever. And for like a week, the pot is just sitting there. And what happened, like, when you first make gumbo, it smells really good, and it's tantalizing, right?
But
it's full of seafood, and it's full of, like, fat and stuff like that. So when it sits after a week, in the kind of humid Louisiana heat that happens, it begins to stink and to reek in such a way that it is unpleasant, not just unpleasant, but it can also be sickening that, you know, to walk in the space in the air. The air is polluted. The space is polluted. You got mold growing now.
Exactly.
You know, like you could probably get penicillin from what's present. And so he was like, yeah, I might have been the one to make it. I might have been like the cause of this situation that's here. But the reality is, if everybody keeps looking at it and the garbage continues to sit there and nobody takes accountability to like clean it up, then it's just going to keep continuing to kill us and disrupt us and disturb us and to pollute the kind of air that we think that we're breathing that should be healthy for us. So whether it was you or your great, 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 great granddaddy, Ben Affleck, who did this work and created what is a white supremacist society through legal institution, through family and economic and political structures or whatever, we are all responsible. Otherwise, we're just bringing generations and generations and generations of people into the world to have to deal with the fact that nobody took accountability and responsibility.
See, that's
to
where that,
do the work to clean the mess up.
That's where that empathy comes in.
Absolutely.
And care. I mean, I keep telling my students over and over, you really, in order to really make a deep change in this world, you have to go back to kindergarten. Sharing is caring.
Right.
You know, all the things they taught you in kindergarten that became a lie.
Right. And guilt has no, like, it doesn't do, and it doesn't move us forward. It actually paralyzes people if that's the emotion that you want to stay in and whether or not you feel guilty about what it
because
is.
Because you're absolutely right. Because one of the things, and I mean, like I've said before, I'm heterosexual and I do a lot of intellectual work with LGBTQ folk. And all I can think about is, first of all, this guilt. I mean, so I bring up my guilt and now we're talking about me. How is that in service to the community that I pretend that I want to be an ally with? So that's why I prefer the term accomplice as opposed to ally, as put forth by the indigenous action media network because accomplices are ready to give up something.
And do work. Like, it's an action evoking work, right?
You have to be willing to put it on the line for the people that you claim to be in service to. You're in service to a people. And a lot of people aren't willing and ready and able to do that. So ally becomes an easy way to, and so it's usually allies that feel guilty because they haven't done the work required to understand what the work is that they're trying to do.
And that it's not about you.
And another thing about it makes it, you know, I always say to my students, you know, if you were going into certain fields, like if you were going to go be a doctor, any kind of doctor except us, like our kind of doctor, a medical doctor, you would be going into medical school thinking to yourself, this is going to be the hardest thing I've ever done in my life. I'm probably going to be up all night long, many nights crying, but it's worth it. I want it that bad. If you can't feel the same way about us, you can exit the space. I mean, because no one is begging that half level work to be here. I mean, it's hard.
A guilty or fragile ally, whether you're white, cisgender,
heterosexual,
what have you, in relationship with the community that is oppressed, is like being in an operating room or being the one asked to go into the operating room with someone as they are getting ready to have life changing, altering, could be life and death surgery, and they potentially are on this table dying, and the surgery is so necessary to give them life that you're in the room and you begin to hyperventilate and pass out and faint. And the doctors, and the doctors and nurses have to attend to you while the person who came into the room is lying on the table about to die because now the attention is so much turned to your hyperventilation. Like, if that's what we're focused on, then I don't need you in the room with me.
And I need you to go take care of yourself. And here's the thing. I need you to go take care of yourself, and I need you to not require oppress people to take care of you. We have been doing that for a very, very long time.
I can't get off the table, you know, and make sure that you can breathe.
But Michael Kimmel, who's a white male sociologist who does this work, he has a great story. You heard it when we were at the National Women's Studies Association conference.
Right.
And he talked about wanting to help his wife with her domestic violence work. And she said, you know how you can help me? Go talk to the men men like you, who perpetrate.
Right.
We have this. We got this figured out. And so I think I think one of the things, and as a person who's in that situation, as a heterosexual person, I can say I find that to be one of my responsibilities, is not to go talk to queer people about what they need to do
in their community and in their struggle,
but to go talk to heterosexual people who have no clue. I think that's also something that people can do if we're talking about visible dues.
Right.
Is to talk to, study up, talk to people, listen to people, and go talk to your own community about how they can affect change.
Right.
Because the last thing I need is for a man to tell me about an ovary, unless he is a very skilled OBGYN. Thank you so much, Dr. Stephanie Stiletto Rose, for taking time out of your very busy day to come and talk to me. I really enjoyed talking to you. I'm glad that we had this chance. I'm thankful to the KRCC family, especially Noel and Jake, for having us both. And I just want to thank you again for being here with me.
It was definitely my pleasure.
This special episode of The Big Something was produced by Jake Brownell and me, Noel Black, for KRCC. The views and perspectives of Dr. Lewis and Dr. Rose do not necessarily represent those of KRCC and Colorado College. You can listen to this episode again at krcc.org. The Big Something is part of KRCC Presents, a weekly showcase of locally produced content right here on Radio Colorado College. Tune in for original, local programming every Friday at 7 p.m. and Sunday at 4 p.m. on 91.5 Radio Colorado College.